Okay, so I've put these.
Does the Chazon Ish address that Ramah anywhere?
Not really. I'm gonna next week show you wait, don't you want to put one on me? And that's the one I knocked out. And leave the other one here. Are they going? They're going already? Yeah. Where do you want to put it? Whatever you want. The Chazon, I'm going to show you a letter of the Chazon Ish next week, a lumdish letter where he says something very deep, very profound. There's a lot to talk about, but you'll see that Rov Binyan Ubinyan all agree with the Chazon Ish. So then the problem is what you say. What do you deal with the Ramah? I'm going to deal with that. That's the Kuntres HaShach. But I've sailed. I've already given a world of material, and I'm in the middle of sailing. You follow me?
There's a real cook about the archaeology questions also, which disagrees with the Chazon Ish.
In relation to what?
I forgot what the sugya was.
You have to show it to me. If you show it to me, I'll appreciate it, because I'm not a bucky in Rav Kuv's writings. Outside the halachic writings, I know a little. Beyond that, I have a mental block, because the Rav in 1959 or 60 told us he can't understand Rav Kook's Hebrew. So I always had a mental block. If the Rav can't understand it, how can I understand it? Okay, but anyway, today is Monday, January 14th, 2013, if I have the date right. It's very confusing for me because the only 13 I know is 1913. And I want to say good morning to my wonderful students sitting in front of me. We have the heat at 25 and it's still cold in the room, but I hope it'll warm up. I want to say good morning to all those across the world. I've gotten a lot of correspondence, and I realize endless emails came into the YU office that the shiur a week ago Sunday got cut off at 1:15. I know why it got cut off. Those of you who see me teach know that I use my hands. Murray Rebbe used his hands, and I knocked the computer, I knocked the recorder off. But Danny tells me that he can fix it because we have a second recording which will be put on, so you'll be able to hear everything. Danny, let me know that it works out. And check each time when you put it on that it goes to the very end, okay? I want to know something, Charlie. How did our mutual friend, how is Morty so smart to leave Israel and go to Florida at this moment in time? We are freezing and Elepta Chazash attack. Okay. With a lot of comments came in onto my recent Shayurim. Let me summarize and then I'll just read you something. Eitz Chaim, how did it begin? And it was, see, we don't have exact records, but I'll tell you what I believe, and more or less I would say this is Gil Klapman's conclusion, Rabbi Klapman, and it was older kids. In other words, they were unhappy with the Maksike Hadat, and kids, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, maybe high school kids of 13, 14, 15, many of these kids were greenhorns yet, they didn't know English, and the parents wanted them to get some real learning. And that's how Eitz Chaim began. We call it an elementary yeshiva, but in the terms of the way we think about an elementary yeshiva, it was not so. It was sort of a supplementary program to 7th, 8th grade, or perhaps 5th, 6th as well, but it wasn't a full-scale elementary yeshiva. RJJ is really the first formal elementary yeshiva. And that's why I told you they called themselves and they would advertise and on the radio, the mama from all the yeshivas in America. The mother, you follow me, Josh? The mother of all the yeshiva in America. And there was truth to it. Yoni, we could quibble, Eitz Chaim was before, but the truth was it was RJJ. It began as Tiferet Yerushalayim. A year later, they changed the name in memory of the chief rabbi. Talmud asked me here, did MTJ name itself MTJ because that was the original name of RJJ. I don't know. You'd have to ask someone if anyone has been written on the history of MTJ, even on RJJ. I'm not aware of any scholarly history, but that's a fascinating question. Now, here is a comment from Nachum Lamb regarding your Monday shiur. Once, as part of orientation, why you offered a tour led by Professor Gurak of Jewish Harlem, his doctorate subject, and the Lower East Side. One place we visited was the Eldridge Street Shul, which was still being renovated. At the entrance, there was a line of pushkas going back to the earliest days of the shul, each labeled for a specific fund. They are Rabbi Meir Bal Hanes for Israel, Berek Habaya, Tikkun Svarim, General Tzaka, Haskarat Neshamat, and one reading, Yeshivat Eitz Chaim. In other words, it was expected that the Balabatim would give to the yeshiva as part of their regular donations. Professor Gurak pointed it out and added, they helped us when we needed it. We should help them now that they need us. We each left a few dollars for the renovation fund. And I think the dean even promised to send some students to help with the actual work and learn a bit about architecture. Okay, so it's an interesting comment, and as I mentioned last week, as the sources talk about, there's no question that Eitz Chaim supported itself with pushkins, with shnavarai, among the masses of the East European Jews on the East Side. Now, regarding Professor Gurak, Nachum asks me, you talk about the fact that you wrote your book on Rabbi Revel, Rabbi Klapman wrote on the period before. Didn't Professor Gurak write a book on YU in the 1980s? Yes, he did, but that's a sociological study. If you're familiar with Professor Gurak's writings, at least most of them, they're not purely historic. The book on the 1980s is a portrait of the men and women who attend Yeshiva University. Now, there is historic material in the book, but it's a sociological overlook. Similarly, right now, three volumes came out, very nice, very beautifully done, three volumes on the history of the Jews of New York. And Professor Gurak wrote the third volume. And I went through the entire volume in preparing the shiurim, and essentially there was very little I gained from them from what I'm interested in. Because once again, it's more of a sociological, political overlook than the pure history that we're looking for someone to do a major work on Rav Shmuel Belkin, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Okay, now we saw how Eitz Chaim began, we saw the poverty, we saw Josh Rothstein coming to the salvation of the few English subjects the boys were learning, buying textbooks. We saw Professor Dushkin's claim that they were so poor they had to buy one Gemara and rip it into three different parts. Whether that's true or not, I will let hang fire. There's no way I can prove, but to me it seems if Rothstein could buy some English books, he certainly could have bought some Gemaras. And what good does it do you to rip the Gemara into three parts if each one is learning a different Gemara? But we'll come to the Gemara, we're going to come to it with next year, Be'ezrat Hashem, when I talk about the first Shas published on American soil and how that came to be. Now, what was very fascinating last week was Avraham Kahn, and there you really become part of the history, and you see Avraham Kahn, who was the general subjects teacher, and it's a prime source because here you have a picture, a photograph of Eitz Chaim, and you get the feeling exactly what was going on. There was one kid who graduated elementary school, and he was a big shot kid. He was teaching the Eitz Chaim younger kids, and Abe Kahn, who had some gymnasium degree from Europe, was teaching the older kids. That gives you an idea. Once again, we're dealing with 7th, 8th grade, perhaps kids of high school age, but it's not really a formal program. It's haphazard, desolatory, but it's a start. Now, Here we move forward and we come into one of the most important moments in the history of Torah, not only in the United States, but in the history of Torah in the modern world, because what happened on the Lower East Side reverberates throughout the world today, and even in the state of Israel, if you're living here and know what's going on, and know what's going on within the Torah world, and the entire thrust and development and the quests, it all goes back to Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Chanan and what happened on the Lower East Side. And the story, I'll cite to you from Gil Clapman in a second, but let's put the story into context. With RJJ's coming to America, as we mentioned, if Reb Yaakov Yosef can go to America, then other Rabbanim could come. And somehow in America you wind up with some of the leading Talmidim of Reb Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. Reb Yaakov Yosef brings a Rabbi Matlin, Moshe Meir Matlin. He was a Dayan. He was in charge of Kashrut. He was a Talmud Chacham Muvhak. He had smicha from Reb Yitzchak Elchanan. There was another Talmud Chacham on the east side, a Rabbi Bernstein. And no one knows when he came to America. See, it's a lot of statistics are lacking. At a certain point, you can find out when anyone came to America, because all the records of Ellis Island were put onto a website. And I know my wife went to the website and was able to find out when her grandparents came to America. But it's not so simple, because you don't know what name they used, what name they were written under, how the name was spelled. You know, we're dealing with East European immigrants 100 and 150 years ago, 125 years ago. So there was a Rabbi Bernstein as well, and he too, he was a Yira Tzaddik, refused to do anything that would get him involved with the pressures of American life, didn't want to get involved with Siddur Kedushin, didn't want to get involved with Geirut, didn't want to make a living in any way where he would have to compromise. I need not tell you, Geirut, the very fact that a rabbi gets in Geirut already raises the whole question of Geirut without full Kabbalat mitzvah. I don't have to tell you, this is a question that doesn't go away, haunts us until this very moment. And even in the election campaign, if you saw the Tashdish Bechirot of Shas that Judge Rubenstein invalidated, and correctly so, but you can see it I believe you can pick it up on Failed Messiah, one of the websites. I saw it on one of the websites. I think I saw it on Vestas Nice, but I believe it's on Failed Messiah, and it's probably on other websites. That problem of Geirut doesn't go away. It's still with us today. All right, a Rav has a choice. You want to be a tzaddik, you remove yourself entirely from getting involved in these issues. If you want to go into the mainstream, you have to be involved. So this Rabbi Bernstein was someone who did not go into the mainstream. How did he make a living? Out of being a mashkiach kashrut in a winery on the Lower East Side. People had to drink wine, people had to eat matzah, you need hashgacha, so Rabbanim could make a living out of hashgacha, and if you gave a decent heksha, and what I mean by a decent heksha is a concept that you don't even understand. It means if you ate from your own hashgacha. I yet heard Rabbanim, I can tell you in Newark, one of my big culture shocks, 1962, I just come to Newark, I'm a young man, Maplewood, South Orange. It was very fruitful 7 years that had a big impact on me, those years in the rabbinate. My first rabbinate was very difficult, and I wasn't prepared for it, they weren't prepared for me. I was all of 23, I got involved with professors and world-famous people and multimillionaires and a rabbi trying to live his type of Yiddishkeit, and they had their concept of their Yiddishkeit. It was a very hard year, 61, 62. The only good thing about the year is I met David Golis's grandparents, the Gornish family, etc., etc. Okay, that was the only good thing. But then I went to Maplewood, South Orange, and so there was already a big rabbinate in Newark, an Orthodox rabbinate, And, you know, we would have meetings. There was never a board of rabbis. We had very little to do with the reforming conservative who ruled all the suburbs but didn't have a foothold in Newark proper. But here I'm sitting at this meeting, and there's a rabbi. He's not alive anymore. I don't want to mention his name, although it's a fact. And he had been a Lubavitcher, and he left Lubavitch, and he was giving hashgacha. And they asked him, "Do you eat from your hashgacha?" And he says, "No, I don't eat from my hashgacha." "How can you give hashgacha if you don't eat from it? How can you give hashgacha?" And this is a real problem. But if you're a non-ist rav and you give a proper hashgacha, that's how he made a living. Now, what happened was, and it's one kid more than anyone else, Rabbi Matlin, and I'm curious if any Matlin surface are listening to the Sheyura, if he has direct descendants who are still in the Torah world. It would be interesting to know. Offhand, I did come across in my years of teaching the Matlin name. It's not unknown to me. And his kid, Akiva, a bright kid came from Europe. He already had started cheder in Europe. He starts studying in America, and he finishes what you would call elementary school, Eitz Chaim. He's going to a night school to learn English. And remember, a lot of Jews learn their English, a lot of immigrants, I should say, in night schools. There's a lot of memoir literature what the night schools were like. And a lot of Jews who became very famous afterwards, their initial contact with school and with English was in a night school that met in a nearby high school, except it met after the workday, after you worked. You came and you started to shed your status of greenhorn. Now, his father was very worried that this kid should learn Gemara. What good is it if the kid is going to go to high school, the kid is going to go to college, the kid is going to conquer English, the kid is going to become an American, but the kid doesn't know Gemara. So Rabbi Matlin started teaching his son Gemara in the house. No, you're a kid. Let's understand the psychology. You're a kid. You finish general school, let's say high school. You get home 4 o'clock. Every other kid is on the street playing. America's America. America's made for children. Children have to enjoy their youth. What kid wants to sit and learn with his father when all his friends are playing down the block? Okay. I remember when I went to Solanta, school began at 8:30, and we get home 5:30, 6 o'clock. I went to MTA, school began at 9, and I'd get home 7 o'clock at night, 7:30 at night, you know, and we didn't know what the word meant, to play, to have a good time, to be a more normal kid. It didn't exist in our vocabulary. Of course, we were the chosen few in the sense that if you continued this lifestyle, it's because libo chashak b'torah, and you wanted to master everything, and you had to master two worlds. We had no choice. I quote the Rav, look into volume 2 of the Rav. You see where Rebbe talks about how he has to force his son. Parents are mad at him. Why do you have such a curriculum? Why do the kids have to have two worlds? He says, but we have no choice. We live in two worlds. Geva toshav anachim achem. And of course, to master two worlds, to be a Bucky and Shas and Paiskim, and to have a doctorate in whatever field you're interested in, this is a challenge. So what did Rabbi Matlin Sr. do? I imagine, I'm putting this in, but the facts are facts. But my theory is, he spoke with a few of his friends. Chaimka, you have a son who should be learning Gemara with Taisvis? Yarchab, Shikim Samir, send him to my house. I'm going to have some candy on the table, and I'm going to teach them Gemara with Taisvis. Before you know it, there were 2 kids, there were 3 kids, there were 4 kids, there were 5 kids. Soon there were so many kids that there wasn't enough room. in Rabbi Matlin's house, you don't realize it's one individual, how he moved the world. You know, there's, if you've taken a course in world history on a collegiate level, so you know there's a whole debate, what shapes history? Is it individuals, or is it events that are beyond the individual, that the individual really is caught up? And my humble opinion is it's the individual who moves history. So now they have to find the shul. And you should know, until today, we don't know for sure which was the first shul they met in. Generally speaking, we say the Marienpol shul. That was the first shul. I believe it was on East Broadway. I think we have the exact address in Gil Clapman's doctorate. However, there is a claim that it began in 1 Henry Street. You know what 1 Henry Street was? It was Eitz Chaim. And I think it's very simple, that originally when Rabbi Matlin saw there were too many kids for his house and he had to move into a larger facility, so he went to Eitz Chaim. Eitz Chaim was happy to accommodate him. Then they became so large, they outgrew Eitz Chaim. The minute they outgrew Eitz Chaim, then they went to 44 East Broadway with the congregation Anshei Emet of Marienpol. Now, what does Marienpol mean? And this I think you know, and anyone who studies the history of the Jews of New York, 44 East Broadway. It's in the heart of the Lower East Side. If you want to know where East Broadway is, it's not far. It's right next to where Tiferet Yerushalayim is today, where RJJ began. East Broadway was a big hub. And right next to East Broadway was the park, the Seward Park. And there you have the Forwards Building. This was, today it's hard to believe what once was, because this whole neighborhood is Chinese. Chinatown, have you been there lately? It's totally overflowed into the East Side. Although MTJ remains where it is, and if you go into MTJ, you'll see Reb David Feinstein, and there's a little group learning there, but it's the last of the Mohegans. So we're not certain the way it began, but I think logically what I'm saying makes sense. Its first location may have been at Henry Street. This was because Eitz Chaim was there. From Eitz Chaim, when the group got larger, it moved to East Broadway. Now, in 1897, it was formally incorporated. In other words, what began in a partisan fashion, when you already have a lot of children and you have to have a home for them and you have to heat the place and you have to have candles burning or kerosene lamps burning, you need money. In order to raise money, you need incorporation. And in 1897, the yeshiva is officially incorporated, and it's given the name Reitz Yeshiva Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. Now, why did they name it Reitz? Why does our yeshiva get this name? And here, you just have to look at the dates. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan died in 1896. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan was the most famous East European Rav. He was not a Rebbe. He was not a Rosh Yeshiva. He was a Posek Mufak. He was revered. And when I say revered, let me just spend a few minutes on it. One of the greatest problems we have in Jewish law, and again, these problems are with us, it's, what, 120-odd years later, we have exactly the same problems. Nothing has changed. One of the greatest problems we have in Jewish law is the fact that a man can have more than one wife, and a woman can have only one husband. So when a wife disappears, bidi avad, a man will be able to get a heter to remarry. After World War II, a lot of literature, I spoke about this quite a few years ago in the Sunday class, is there such a thing as a heter agunim? Not a heter aguna, a heter of an agun. The word agun is basically a word that we rarely use. But women whose husbands disappear are agunat. And what is the word agunat? What does the word agunat come from? The Gemara Baba Batra, ogain, anchored. She's anchored. She can't budge. She has no husband, and yet she can't remarry. She can't budge. And this is a very sad situation. Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan wrote 5 volumes of response to literature. He was most famous from over 160 Heterei Agunot. And it's not just Heterei Agunot. You're talking about thousands upon thousands of women that he permitted to remarry. If you look into Rakafar Aaron, I believe it's Chelik Bet, you'll see a study that my friend Aaron Rakefet published at the 100th yahrzeit of Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan. Why did I work on that topic and publish it? Because a doctorate was done in Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan at Yeshiva, at Bernard Rebel Graduate School, by someone I knew quite well, Rabbi Dr. Ephraim Shimov, Zichrono Livracha. But Rabbi Shimov's doctorate, which was later published by Surah Institute of Yeshiva University, he did not deal with Aguna. He dealt with everything else. And Rabbi Belkin, in writing an introduction to the volume, Rabbi Belkin writes that he was very smart not to deal with Aguna because this is too difficult a topic for the populace to understand. Well, that was the 1950s. You have to understand it, Yitzchak. But by 1996, Aaron Rakefet felt the world can understand the topic of Aguna if written in proper English. So I deal with it in depth, and I give you a simple example which I lectured on for 2.5 years. But let's say a boat goes down, a plane goes down, Lo'aleinu. By the way, Halacha L'maisa, Rabbi Schoenfeld, those of you who know Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld, this is his second wife. His first wife died of cancer. His first wife was Lord Jacobowitz's sister, and she died very young. This is her second husband, Ruth's very happy second marriage. They each had 4 children when they married, and I believe they had twins together at the end. 9 and 10, I believe, are twins. It can be checked out anywhere from Kew Gardens Hills. It's a well-known story. Now, her husband was a survivor. She was a Rebbe's Hatachta. She was a Chassidic Rebbe's daughter, and she married a survivor who was a businessman. And one Motzoi Shabbos in November, when Shabbos ended early, there was a flight to South America, and they were in the import-export business. And on that plane were a number of Hasidic Jews who were going for business reasons to South America. And the plane went down I think it didn't even hit the Atlantic Ocean. It was in the bay, in the channel. And I don't know if the bodies were ever recovered, but right away the plane goes down. You have no bodies. A boat sinks. A soldier goes to war. And when you don't have a body, the woman is an aguna. And Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan was matir. There are cases where he was matir. Boats burning in the ocean. And it was based upon the principle of trei rubei, of double doubt, meaning, logically speaking, when a plane goes down in the ocean, the overwhelming majority of people do not survive. Okay? But that's not enough. Midioraita, that's enough. According to Torah law, we always follow a majority. Midioraita, that should be enough. But the famous sugya in Yavamba, Daf Kuf Chaf Aleph, you can look up the sugya, it's a famous sugya that there are always miracles. And that's why Maim Shendel himself, the story of Rabbi Akiva, the story of Rabbi Meir, how they were capsized and the waves, and as each wave came, they held on to a piece of the boat, of the canoe, whatever, the life raft, and they simply went over the wave. And they come to shore, they're sitting shiver for them. And here they walk in alive. So you see, there are miracles. So a robe is not enough. Midrabbanan, it's under the rabbinic rubric of Mayim She'ein Lachem Sof. It's Siman Yud Zayin in Shulchan Aruch Evin Ezra, if I'm not mistaken. It's a very big siman. Aye, but that's at least one majority. Then Reb Chochanan followed Reb Lezer, and again we call him in Tosfos Reb Lezer Verdun, but I'm told that that's incorrect. But that's the way the Balei Tosfos referred to him. Rabbi Reich corrected me to the exact city he was from. But that's the way the Balei Tosfos referred to him, the Rishonim referred to him, and he says, Avad Zichro, that's the next rubric. What does Avad Zichro mean? That the person, if he doesn't return, doesn't contact his family, it's a sign that he is dead. Now, this is not a simple matter. And this is based upon a Mishnah, Yevamet, Shalom Lom, Shalom Lom. I can't go into all the details. But what is involved here, my dear friends, how many of us are happily married? I'll talk about myself. Don't raise your hands yet. You don't know what's going to happen. When you're happily married, the first thing you're going to do is call your wife, right or wrong. Some guys disappear, and the first thing they think, oh, Baruch Hashem, I don't have to look at that shrew again. Let her rot in hell. I don't give a damn about her. So you see, Zalo Pashut, he can very well be alive, but Avad Zichro, because he wanted to be Avad Zichro. You understand? Chazal and the Rishonim and the Achronim knew what life was about. Their famous Gemaras, where one of Moras says, my wife is a shrew, but she keeps me from sinning sexually. That's why I have to honor her. Other people had different marriages, I don't have to tell you, but the Gemara had the entire gamut. That's why when someone quotes one Maimon Chazal and wants to build the case, he's not fair, because the Gemara represents the entire spectrum of human experience. So Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan, and this is following already earlier Tshuvot of the Chatam Sofer and others, and Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, but Yitzchak Chanan formalized it. That Allah had come and become a bisman hazel when there are telegraphs already. There were telegraphs where there's international mail, where there are newspapers, Zeitungs. If the man had been alive and he loves his wife and he lived normally with her, and the people know, all right, every couple, I guess, has a spat once in a while. When the older you grow, believe me, if you have seichel, the less you argue, and as my grandchildren know, Hakol achareha isha, she is the boss. I decide when to bomb Iran, but all the minor decisions I leave for my wife. Believe me, I'm a very smart individual. It works fabulously. So you understand, Rabbi Chochanan was fabulous. If we know the couple lived a normal life, and he doesn't contact, and a reasonable amount of time went by, you have the second row of Avad Zichro, Sveik Sveika. Majority die in a boat crash at sea, and if he would have survived, the majority would have contacted their wives by now. The fact that a year went by and he didn't contact his wife, now I need not tell you, he became world famous. He was called Avi HaAgunot. And when he died, Reb Chaim Chenowitz, Rab Tzair, who was a Talmid of Yitzchak Chanan, began his hesped, like they said for Shol HaMelech, the daughters of Israel should cry. You've lost your greatest defender, your greatest patron. People loved him. People worshipped him. People came to America with his picture on the wall. If you've seen pictures of the tenements on the Lower East Side, occasionally you'll see a picture of a Rav on the wall. 9 out of 10 times, if it's not a Hasidic home, that is a picture of Reb Yitzchak Chanan Spector. So that naming the yeshiva after Reb Chanan Spector was as natural as putting a glove on your hand. And I can tell you, Mori Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, when he would speak about different Gedolei Yisrael, I can't do it all now, but just to hint at it, Chochma Bina V'dat. So he developed the idea, there's some people that have tremendous knowledge, Bekiyot. Some people have Bina, Harifot. And you all know, you have different Rosh Yeshiva, the big fight in Voloshin 160 years ago, Dinitziv, those that supported Dinitziv, those that wanted Rabbi Yosef Dov to be Rosh Yeshiva, those who wanted Dinitziv. So everyone who lived the period, like any other machleket, you get involved with Talmidim, of course, Shalom L'Shem Shemayim, terrible things were done, ink was spilled over Gemaras, etc., etc. Gemaras were turned upside down, backwards in the library, so when the Netziv came in, he couldn't tell which Gemara was which. All you saw were pages staring at you. But the real machleket was based upon the Gemara at the end of Brachat Sinai V'Yoka Harim, Mi'adif. Who do you choose? And it's a very personal matter. You've had teachers, no? Who is your favorite Rebbe? Who did you look up to as the most influential, biggest Lamdan? Was it a Rebbe who was a big bucky, that was his dominant feature? Or a Rebbe who was filled with chiddush, charifut, Sinai ve'okah harim, mi adif? And there's no black and white answer. But both of them doesn't mean that I had a paskin. The Rav said that is the ability to apply it. And when the Rav gave an example of someone who knew how to apply the halacha, his example was Rav Yitzchak Chaim Spector. I can tell you, in the 20th century, it was Rav Chaim Meiser who took the crown from Rav Yitzchak Chaim Spector. You follow me? That crown passed on to Rav Chaim Meiser. That was Rav Chaim Meiser's gauntlet. So you see, Rav Yitzchak Chaim Spector, it was logical. He died in 96. These kids are learning together. 97. Name the new institution, Rav Yitzchak Chaim Spector. And that's how the name was born. Now, let me quote some of the information from the wonderful doctorate of Rabbi Dr. Gil Klapperman. Rabbi Moshe Meir Matlin was the one that was most known. He was born in 1885 in Sklutsk, Lithuania, was a big Gili in his youth, got smicha from Rav Yitzchak Chaim, came to America in the 1890s when Rabbi Jacob Joseph sent for him. When Rabbi Yaakov Yosef was still functioning, he was one of his mashgichim. When Rabbi Yaakov Yosef stopped functioning, he became a mashgiach for private individuals. In other words, he was no longer organized, the chief rabbinate, but he continued to make a living, essentially involved with the kosher supervision of wine. Wine was a tremendous industry. Jews had to drink, and by and large, the masses, even if they weren't Shomer Shabbos totally, but they were makpid to have Jewish wine, not stam yenam. Rabbi Dr. Philip Klein, we'll talk about him, but not yet, one of the most highly respected, what we would call in our language today, a YU type or a modern Orthodox rabbi, wrote about Rabbi Matlin, quote, "He is one to whom no one can compare in nobility of character and piety." So you start to understand who this Rabbi Matlin was. Rabbi Yehuda David Bernstein, who was older, was born near Kovna 1863 and also was an Eloi. They say he knew the Mishnah Torah by heart. All the writings, halachic writings of the Rambam, he was totally conversant, A to Z. We don't know when he came to America. There's no recorded history of it. But he saw what America was like. And like I said before, he tried to be a businessman. Whenever Rabbanim tried to be businessmen, inevitably they become bankrupt. You don't have a better example than, remember what we spoke about in class? Was it this year, last year, Reb Tzvi Hirsch Rabinovitz? No, who was Reb Tzvi Hirsch Rabinovitz? Mit of a Rav? He was the son of Reb Yitzchak Chaim Spector. And didn't you all ask me, why does he have a different last name? Rabinowitz? Rabinovich? It's the son of Rabbi Yisrael Chanan Spector. What's going on here? He denies his parentage. He denies his yiches. And remember what I told you? He went into business. He saw the Akmas Nefesh his father had, klal work, rav. Listen, it's not easy to be a rabbi. Moshe Rabbeinu had plenty of problems being the rav of the Jewish people. And if Moshe Rabbeinu had problems, what can we expect to have? Matan is so frightened already, he lost some of his hair, and he winds up studying to be a lawyer instead of being a rav gadol b'torah. So, why did he change his name? He went bankrupt. And when you go bankrupt in Russia, in order to start again, you have to change your name. You have to show, I'm not the person who went bankrupt. I'm starting afresh. And that was the law. So he took his mother's maiden name, Rabinowitz. And then he went into the rabbinate. And he was mitzvah rav, and halavai they would have brought him to America. In retrospect, who knows, had they brought the Reb Tzvius Rabinovich, he might have had more worldliness because he saw his father in the rabbinate and Kuzna. Maybe he could have been better in New York. I don't know. But Rabinovich, rabbis go bankrupt. Bernstein went bankrupt. He had to go back to the rabbinate, but he refused to do anything, and he too winds up a mashgiach in an east side winery. But look at this beautiful description from memoir literature. Despite his financial difficulties, early students of Reed's knew Rabbi Bernstein as a cheerful, generous man with a sparkling sense of humor. Often, he would brighten the long midnight vigils of the yeshiva bacharim at their studies by bringing them bags of candy and fresh fruit. And I want to tell you, nothing has changed. I see signs up in this building, Yeshiva Torah Traga. What was it? Hanukkah time? The kids that will learn extra hours and won't run around to see the monkeys in the zoo. They were off. You keep track of it? What were they offering? I think for a total of 30 hours, Papa Pagino, if you can give me the proper pronunciation. All that you can eat. All that you can eat. Well, who is it? Papa Guy? Papa Guy? How do you know what goes on here? You're from Hollywood. Papa Guy? Well, I don't even know what it is. They call me some Italian food place. What is it? Who needs Italian food? Eat Jewish food. Let the Italians eat Jewish food. Then. No, yes, sir. No, I know. The one, remember, there used to be, when we came in Aliyah 44 years ago, there was one on Pfefferberg. Remember Pfefferberg with Mamish Yiddish Essen? I think in B'nai Brak, I'm told, in the building that you can't get into, the Diamond District building, in that building, does for Zelchen a Yidden, Dapman Hodman Yiddish Essen. But okay, my grandchildren think pizza was invented in Israel. And I try to tell them when Richie's opened here, the few American kids who were here, the early 70s, they were dancing on the streets. And everyone knew all the boys and girls used to meet Saturday night in Richie's. That was the hangout. BMT, Machon Gold, whatever you had there. And Shidduchim came out of it, and happy marriages came out of it. I've taught children of those boys and girls, and they look forward to teaching their grandchildren one day, Be'ezrat Hashem. So, you see, he brought them bags of candy and fresh fruit. To the more accomplished students, he presented gifts of scholarly volumes and Talmudic commentaries. All who remember him carry the impression of his deep piety and great scholarship. Okay, now, Reitz has begun. Reitz, more or less we can use the word, is on the map. It has a location. According to Gil Klatman, it began at 1 Canal Street, which was Eitz Chaim. Then it moved to the Marion Pohl Synagogue, and the Marion Pohl Synagogue becomes its initial home. Fine. Akiva Matlin is one of the key students. He's the one for whom the yeshiva was founded. His father put a lot of effort into him. Everything began so Akiva should have classmates, so Akiva shouldn't look at the kids playing stickball on the block, so Akiva should feel he's not being deprived. His father did everything possible to give him an environment, friends, and you understand, friends have a lot of influence. What do we call it? Peer pressure. The younger you are, the greater the influence your friends have. I need not tell you what high school is all about. I can tell you college as well. I have friends in their 70s and 80s. And all they talk about is their days in yeshiva college. They relive it day in and day out. I can tell you that made them, that built them, that was friendship. Then you move into life, dog eat dog, whatever life is all about. It's a different ballpark. What happened to Akiva Matlin? And here, very fascinating. Akiva Matlin, and Reitz begins because of him. We should put a plaque up. If we had any feeling of history and art scroll understanding, which we should learn from them. Now I'm not being critical. There should be a plaque when you enter the main academic center, what today is MTA, or whatever you want to call that beautiful, gorgeous building. You don't know what that building means. You have no concept. Jews, East European Jews, schnurrers, peddlers, panhandlers, built a building like that in the 1920s when Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog visited America for the first time in 1941 and saw that building. He broke into tears. You should know that. He couldn't believe you could build such a beautiful Torah, such a beautiful building dedicated to Torah. And when you enter that building, which originally had golden domes, real gold on the domes, that was sold during the Depression years, there should be a plaque. We owe everything to a little kid named Akiva Matlin. Now, what happened to Akiva Matlin? Akiva Matlin, and I'll give you the source. It's in, you'll see it's this is the source there. You'll see another source as well, but that confirms that. Page 210 in The Story of Yeshiva University by Gil Klapperman, footnote 18. And what happened was very simple. The kid conquered America, went to college, did fabulous, went to medical school. And it seems in medical school, you know, how many Jews went to medical school today? Every third Jewish kid is in medical school. I myself have a grandson in medical school. He has a brother who could have also, a brother, I don't know, aeronautical engineering. That's what he's interested in. He didn't, he could have gone, bright kid could have chosen any school he wanted here. So he's also in the Technion, but he's not in medical school. He's in the School of Engineering. What do I ask my grandson whenever I see him? How many bodies have you worked on this week? And, and I don't have to tell you, medical school, bodies, the whole discussion, can you, can't you, what do you do for bodies? What does a Kohen do? All right? This haunts us. This haunts us. We had a kid in our class who was a Kohen. I don't want to mention the name. And we went over to Rebbe, how do you let him go to medical school? He's going to go to medical school. And the Rebbe very elegantly says to us, his father's a Talmud Chacham. His father was a Musmach of Rav Kook. Rav Yitzchak HaKohen Kook was a Rav who got smicha in Eretz Yisrael. And he says, let his father deal with him. It's not my responsibility. Okay? Then they were working here, Poli Agudat Yisrael. How do we solve the problem? According to Agudat Yisrael, we don't need medical schools. Let the Goyim be doctors. But according to Poli Agudat, they already were much closer to Mizrahi. How are we going to build a Jewish state without doctors? So, no, you can check this out. I'm not playing games now. So in the mid-50s, there was a whole discussion. There were a lack of bodies in Switzerland as well, and they wanted to come up with a plastic human being, a human being that they could work on, I'm serious, with all the organs, but it was all artificial. So he asked Rebbe, this is classic Rav Soloveitchik. So he asked Rebbe, look what the new, might be a solution, Kohanim. And the Rav says, tell me, would you like a doctor to work on your body who never dealt with that ill body before? Believe me, I wouldn't like such a doctor to work over my body. That was the Rav's classic, insightful, brisker answer. Right on. And the artificial body syndrome fell away. Ah, but gentlemen, what I didn't tell you was that Akiva Matlin was a Kohen. His father found out that he has to cut up bodies. I guess they didn't realize what's involved in medical school. And you can imagine how bright this kid was if he gets into medical school, when who the heck wanted Jews in the medical profession? And the father ordered him home. No, if you can't be a doctor, he became an accountant. And here, read what Gil Klappman has to say. According to his brother, Louis Matlin, and his wife, Rebecca, these were the son of Rabbi Matlin, the founder, and his daughter-in-law, Rebecca. Akiva's Matlin studies were interrupted by a delicate religious problem. The Matlins were Kohanim, of priestly descent, who, according to Jewish law, prohibited from being exposed to corpses. When Akiva wrote his father that he had reached the stage where he already was dissecting cadavers, Rabbi Matlin was horrified. Akiva was ordered home immediately and found a job as a bookkeeper in a slaughterhouse. Okay? And evidently, that's the way he spent his life. No one has ever been able to come up with a chetta outside of Rav Gorin's tshuva. And Rav Gorin's tshuva was never accepted. It dealt with a kohen being tamei already, wearing a ring, wearing a bracelet. The bracelet has tumah. You got to look at the tshuva to see what Rav Gorin came up with. And since he's already tamei, it wasn't accepted. We have never yet found a solution for a kohen and cadavers and dissection and being a medical doctor. Yeah, the conservative movement feels, and Rabbi David Hartman feel very happy about that. What are you talking? How can you say you're going to ignore halacha?
Don't we have
Yitzchak, I asked you to check with them how they got a chetter to go to medical school and let me know. So you're answering your own question. They didn't get a chetter, they did an Issa, but later in life, Baruch Hashem, they came back belay the nefesh. I see Rabbi Matlin yelled at his son, brought him home very quickly. And the Rav, I know, had a lot. The Rav didn't tell us that our classmate could go to medical school. The Rav just said, let his father tell him. His father knows what he's doing. What was he really doing? It was the Rav, you know, he didn't butt in. He kept his distance. Rav Kefir has given many lectures where the Rav, three times in life, left his usual mold and went into the public thoroughfare. No one has said Rav Kefir is wrong. As a matter of fact, I have a footnote where, you know, I don't elaborate now, but I elaborated 20, 30 years ago in this very class where Tova Lichtenstein totally agreed with me that the Rav's bad experience in Boston with the Kashrut scandal forced him to modify his own feelings and recognize he's better off staying away from controversy and pushing people around. It comes with maturity, it comes with age, and later in life, When I learned in Lakewood, I remember there was criticism of the Rebbe, he doesn't take public stands, and the Rebbe was very smart. When he did take a public stand, he changed the world. The fact that there's a modern Orthodox, the fact that Hartman's Shira Chadasha has a mechitza with all its innovation is due to the Rebbe's public stand, that a Torah shul has to have a mechitza. It's an amazing thing today. Everyone is conservative in this type of thinking, but a mechitza they have. A mechitza they have. That's because of the Rav. Halacha tamah v'kamah, that all these Orthodox shuls today in America, that these young men get smicha, no one asked them what they asked us. Will you take a shtela without a mechitza? Remember? That was the only question we were asked. They're not even asked this, because every shtela has mechitza. They have different problems. Will you take a shtela where the women dance with the Sefer Torah in the synagogue on Simchas Torah? Ah, will you take a shtela where every Shabbos, Mavochim, Rosh Chodesh, the women have their own, minyan, but they have their own prayer group, and afterwards they have a beautiful collation, because Rosh Chodesh is a Chag of Nashim. Will you take a shtela where a scholar from one of the programs Rakefet spoke about yesterday is visiting from Israel, and they want to give the drasha? These guys have real problems. We didn't. Our problem is heavy. I know. Nechama Leibowitz, with such an anti-feminist, you have no idea. I knew Nechama intimately. Read her biographies today. She was the antithesis of the feminist movement. She was kula Torah, kula Litvish. Nechama Leibowitz. What an individual. Okay, don't get me started on Nechama, or it'll take the rest of the Shia. Now, so Akiva Matlin, that story is unique, and it makes for a good movie. What an ending. That here he is, he remains firm, he knows how to learn, he's a genius, university, medical school, and he has to give it all up, and his father has to find a position for him as a bookkeeper in a schlachter's, in a slaughterhouse. Now, what's very fascinating, who were these students? What happened to them? We don't have records, but we do have names that have been thrown around. There is some memoir literature. Some of it wound up in the local Yiddish press at that time. And you have to understand, let me describe to you what the situation was. Look at the state of Israel today. I'm not talking about when I went in Aliyah. It's a different story altogether. Today you have nefesh b'nefesh. You come into the state, there's no pressure on you to learn Hebrew. The truth of the matter is that many of the jobs happen to be in English. You go into high tech. The knowledge of English is a tremendous asset. The more you know, the better you are in English, the more you can handle the computer, the more you can program, the more you can be on an international level. There's no pressure. People can live here 40, 50 years and never learn Hebrew and be very successful. This is a country built the gathering of exiles. And you feel comfortable. When all is said and done, we were all raised a certain way. Lech lecha, miyatzecha, miyladcha, mibeit avicha. And you know Rakefet Zvotnit, which is probably not unique to Rakefet. Many times I've said Vetlach, and then I hear the Rav saying it on tape long before I dreamt it up. But the Seder is wrong. Lech lecha, miyatzecha, you leave America last. Mimoladcha, you leave New York after Beit Avicha. And yet, look at the order. America, New York, your father's house. And the answer is very simple, that, all right, we're Americans. Big deal. All right, we grew up in New York, have good memories. But the hardest to leave is your mentality, your father's house, your language, your frame of reference. Aliyah is difficult. But today, the country is built. You don't feel out of place. Whatever profession you're in, plenty of doctors still speak Russian, still speak English. Go into Shaarei Tzedek, go into Hadassah, you'll understand what I'm saying, particularly English, because everyone has to deal with English medical terms, even Russians, even Frenchmen, you have to deal with English. Even de Gaulle had to back down. You don't remember when he decreed that all textbooks in France have to be in French language. And they told him, you're going to produce doctors for a third world country. So even the great de Gaulle, Yimach Shmo v'Zichro, was an anti-Semite at the end of his life. Even he had to back down. But now when you come to America, you just think you're a greenhorn. You got to be part of America. It's not New York today or California today or Miami Beach today. When you're landing in Los Angeles Airport, you think you're in Cuba. You think you're in Mexico. You know what I'm talking about? The announcements. Spanish and English, and even the English is in such a broken English you don't understand one damn word. I just was in Newark Airport, they're making announcements beyond comprehension. But 100 years ago, America, you came in, you had to learn the language, you had to integrate, otherwise you're a green one, you're a second-rate citizen. You're a Johnny come lately. So you see, kids came to America. These were kids in Europe. Everyone sat in a base medrash. Everyone learned. What did a kid do from a frum house? You all know when Veloshin Yeshiva, no, you don't know, but I know. I heard Rabbi Soloveitchik talk about it, but I know it myself. I heard Rabbi on a tape recently. And they told me it's upstairs, that it's on the YU website. I spoke with Rob Shaw, whether they're going to be putting it up on the YU website. The Rabbi spoke about Torah Umata and wonderful, wonderful lectures. But a kid in Europe, when Veloshin Yeshiva was established, Josh, they asked, what do you need a yeshiva for? Every kid sits and learns. And that was Europe. All right, Reb Chaim gave an answer, but it's not for now. But every kid sat and learned. Some kids already went to a more formal education. Then they come to America. And these kids are caught between two worlds. And what yeshivas, Rabbi Yitzchok Hanan became, it became a halfway house. You all know what a halfway house is. Lahavdil between a halfway house, someone going out of jail. He's been in jail for 2 years, white collar crime. The last half year of his sentence, they allow him to live in Manhattan, allow him to work. He has to sleep in the house. He has to check in by 9 o'clock at night. That's a halfway house. They're getting him ready. They're gearing him. They're letting him slowly adjust to life outside of prison. Lahavdil, yeshivas for Yitzchok Hanan became like a halfway house. Kids came there. Gizitzin, Galerin, did what they did in Europe, felt at home, felt happy, but they were never at peace because they knew they had to Americanize. And these kids were clamoring. General studies, help us out. Many of them said or felt at that time, we want to be frum, we want to be good Jews, we want to be learned, we want to be knowledgeable. We want to master Shas and Paiskim. But we live in America. We have to speak the language of America. We have to have knowledge. We have to have panasa. And this becomes a constant tension at Yeshiva Sreb Yitzchok Hanan. It's not going to be solved for another 10, 12, 13 years. It's ongoing. It creates tremendous strife. Why? Because the people that support the place are all greenhorns who made it in America. But they made it in America, they didn't have to speak a good English. They didn't need any degrees. Man darf nur verstehen ein bisschen. All of you know what the word abyssal means. All you have to do is know a little English. What do these boys want? We want a yeshiva. We want guys to sit and learn. We want a mitzvah of Talmud Torah. We want a mitzvah of Zvulun and Yisachar. We want a mitzvah like that. Let Yisachar sit and learn. And we're the Zvulun who will support them. But we're not willing to support young men who are going to spend half a day mastering English, mastering general knowledge. And this was tremendous tension. What is the yeshiva? What is its role? Underneath the surface, there was another trend, fear, challenge. Call it what you wish. My dear students, 1 million East European Jews are in America, 1.5 million, 2 million. They need rabbis. Who's going to supply the rabbis for them? JTS? That's not their type of rabbi. They still need rabbis 100+ years ago. Rabbis who think in Yiddish, speak in Yiddish, laugh in Yiddish, cry in Yiddish. Rabbis who are learned, rabbis who are knowledgeable. Their children need rabbis who speak both Yiddish and English already. These kids that in Yiddish and shtuk, they speak Yiddish at home. But afmgas, outside on the street, they're speaking English. There's a demand. And many of these kids yet appreciated a traditional rabbi. Remember the story I told you with Yehuda the Leib Feuer in Holyoke? We'll come, we'll talk about him in more detail when we talk about the rabbinate in America. But Yehuda the Leib Feuer is a classic example. We're talking about arguably the greatest Talmid Chacham ever to set foot in the United States. Talking about the Major Tulis Chavruta. You're talking about the Rav stood in awe of him. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik called him the greatest bucky he ever met in his life. Rav Lezer Silber wouldn't pass in a difficult shaila without getting Rav Yehuda Leib Feuer's opinion. I don't know what we're talking about. And you all know, in Holyoke, when finally they organized a conservative temple, they would never appoint a permanent rabbi. They said, Rabbi Zaitun Zerav, Rabbi Feuer was their rabbi. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they brought in a student from the seminary, you follow me, to speak, Sam, to speak in English. But their rabbi was Rabbi Yehuda Leib Feuer. There's stationery. I went and saw a picture of stationery of this conservative temple, and it says, Rabbi Yehuda Leib Feuer, rabbi, or senior rabbi. And let's do something about it. We have reeds. We have students. Give them a program. Give them classes. Give them the tools by which to succeed in the rabbinate. I saw here my colleague, my friend, we grew up together. I know Yisrael Levitz, 70 years. I saw the program he's running for you here. Outstanding. Brings in speakers on all the topics you have to deal with in the rabbinate. Emotional problems, social problems, sexual problems. Well, Elena, we have terrible problems today. This very hard for my generation to comprehend. I've told you that. I saw Harry Merrillis writes the same thing. I totally agree with him. It is difficult for me to even think about the terrible sexual problems we have across the gamut of the Orthodox world. Across the gamut. I used to think it's Charedim, it's Charedim, it's modern Orthodox, it's YU today. God have mercy. Shem Yerachem Aleinu, something's rotten in the kingdom of Denmark. My felicitations to Hamlet. We need a Rebbe Yisrael Salanta. We need someone to say the truth. everything is fine. Put on. I once had I remember Machon Gold, I'm still shaking, a girl confided in me, her brother, who she told me, my brother wears a black hat. He was raping the girl from the time she was 13 on. A Talmidah of mine. I can still see what she looks like. Ugh. And as my grandson says, at least it's a boy and a girl. Take a look what else we have today. God have mercy. You have classes. I never saw anything like it. Beautiful classes. You're being prepared. No, the fellas on the east side of 1900s. Give us a chance. We want to do something. Now, the Balabatim could not start to understand what they're talking about. Mirzain from Mirvein in Don America, Mirmachin Geld, Lassus Tzuru. We're religious. We live in America. We make a living. We succeed. We know a good English. We know enough English to get by. What's good for us is good for you. And these were tremendous tensions that Reitz had. What's fascinating, we know about 12 students who came there from Europe, greenhorns, studied there. What became of them? Eli Friedman, Benjamin Friedman, Moshe Robinson, and Leib Soloway. The minute you hear the name Soloway, what does it tell you? Soloveitchik. Who knows if this isn't the great-grandfather of the new president of Yale? You know what they became? Physicians. That was the ultimate achievement of a Jew in America. These were all students in Reitz in 1901. The research comes up with all these names. Five of them became doctors. Akiva Matlin attended the medical school, but never completed his training for the reason we saw. Some of the others, these are famous names, Ephraim Lissitzky, Samson, later Handler, I recognize these names. Hebrew teachers, Hebrew writers, no longer totally religious. Maskilim, the United States. Only one of the students from that period, Yosef Naftali Rosenberg, became a rabbi. Out of 12 names, only one became a rabbi. One of them became very famous, Harry Rogoff, known as Hillel Rogoff. Who was he? Remember Abe Kahn? When Abe Kahn retired, who succeeded him as the editor of the Jewish Daily Forwards, the socialist newspaper, Hillel Rogoff. But I have to say, and someone should check this out with YU, evidently some connection with Torah remained, because I know that every year, I believe, there is an endowed lecture at YU in memory of Harry Hillel Rogoff, editor of the Forwards. So it's fascinating. Jewish minds, Jewish head, a Yiddish cup. Kids came in with no English, with no background, conquered America, Reitz graduates, medical school, university, literature, fabulous success story. But the tension remained. General subjects, rabbinic training. We have a yeshiva. How can we broaden it? And here we come to a name I mentioned before, and let's say a few words about him. Rabbi Dr. Philip or Hillel Klein was the leading Torah personality for the East European community, although basically he was not East European, following the death of RJJ. His years 1849-1926. Who was he? A Hungarian, raised in a rabbinic home. But if you look at a map, Hungary is in Central Europe. Central Europe is right near Germany. He already was very broad. A Hungarian Talmud Chacham, PhD from the University of Berlin, ordination from Hildesheimer's Rabbinic Seminary. He was broad. Came to America to become the rabbi. Before he came to America, he was rabbi in Latvia. When you look at Latvia, Latvia is not that far from Germany. Look at the map. Latvia, too, had an element that appreciated a rabbi doctor. He came to America to be rabbi of the most famous Hungarian shul, Oheb Tzedek. Where is it today? On the Upper West Side. Some of you met your wives at the single scene at Oheb Tzedek. If I'm incorrect, don't correct me with the facts. When I want your opinion, I will give it to you. But many a young man, many a young girl, and Oheb Tzedek has a very rich history, which I personally am very proud of. Can anyone tell me why? During Rabbi Klein's days, Oheb Tzedek was on the map. And a few rabbis down, Rabbi Theodore or Teddy Adams, Oheb Tzedek was fabulous. And then the neighborhood started to change. Fallout from Harlem, Oheb Tzedek starts going down, and the great Oheb Tzedek, with such a rich history, is barely functioning. And they pick up a young rabbi, a student of Aaron Rakefet, in BMT, not even Gruss, named Rabbi Alan Schwartz. And take a look what Oheb Tzedek is today. The regentrified upper west side, right next to Harlem. Oheb Tzedek, one of the major shuls in New York City. That's the shul where Rabbi Klein, that synagogue, that tradition, that Hungarian congregation, that's where Rabbi Klein, it was called the first Hungarian congregation of New York City, Oheb Tzedek, it was its formal name, First Hungarian Congregation, Oheb Tzedek, that's where he was rabbi. But he was admired by the East European Jews. He was a Rav, he was a Talmud Chacham, he threw himself into Klal Yisrael work. He was a big supporter. If you recall, I mentioned he gave RJJ a lot of help. And now, as Reitz starts to expand, as the problems come up and students are speaking a language that the board of directors do not fully understand, in 1902, Rabbi Klein becomes the president of Reitz. And for the first time, there's someone in control or someone who has a certain amount of power and influence, someone who can understand the students, who has compassion, who has mitlid for this feeling we need more general studies. We have to be more practical. We have to hold on to the better students, and they should become rabbis, and they should be an impact America needs a real East European Orthodox rabbinical school. And that is Rabbi Klein. Does he have total success? Absolutely not. He is revered, he is admired, but the problems ameliorated to a small degree, but they still remain. And finally, a special treat. How history is totally, completely rewritten, falsified, stories are told that have no basis in reality. But for a little bit money, they will sell Kol HaTorah Kula to the highest bidder. And I am furious. And I return to Rabbi Yonah Landau's work, the Rav HaKol of Dr. Blau. You better tell him every syllable I have said and will say right now. Page 273, beginning. He describes the Rav HaKolel visited Rav J.J. We're talking about, you know the book, the Rav HaKolel and his generation, authored by Rabbi Yonah Landau, translated by C.B. Weinfeld, edited by Deborah Schechter, second revised edition, maybe the next edition, corrected by Aaron Rakefet Rothkopf, third revised edition. There's as much chance as that happening as my becoming a Satmar Chassid or dancing on the moon. And he describes how the Rav HaKolel, take it easy, Josh. The Rav HaKolel visited Yeshiva Etz Chaim. Yoni, he loved the yeshiva. He loved the Talmidim. They were learning Torahs like Eastern Europe, but he couldn't devote time to the yeshiva because of the kashrut. And yes, you all understand Halavai RJJ would have had more time, but the kashrut remains a problem. It's not like today where kosher food is available all over the world, even where you fall off the globe, it's available. I was at the other end of Australia, across the street from the hotel, all the kosher food you want, and I don't think there's one Jew there. There's just Aborigines and tourists. In 1896, after the Patira of Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan, the Kovna Rav, the Yeshiva Etz Chaim officially changed its name to Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. Well, right, the facts are wrong. It didn't officially change its name. It's two institutions, but okay, that's a minor error. Rav Moshe Meir Cohn Matlin, a future Rosh Yeshiva in the Yeshiva, was one of the main agitators in favor of the name change. It was he who called on a sefer to discuss the change and also how the yeshiva could be expanded. It was decided to add additional classes and open a class for Bar Mitzvah Bachurim. This totally nothing to do with reality, but again, not so terrible. Page 277. In the beginning, Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Hanan had won the support of all the Elecha Rabbanim in New York and beyond. The Magid Yishir, Elecha Yunga Light, and the learning was pure L'shem Shemayim. Later, when the yeshiva hired the educated Dr. Dov Revel as the Menachel, and he introduced college courses, its philosophy began to veer to the left. Many Rabbanim, mostly those from Hasidic backgrounds, began to agitate against the yeshiva. First of all, let me correct Dr. Dov Revel. Is Harav Dov Hamachune Dr. Revel. He was a Gon Adir, knew every Tosvat and Shas by heart. I know that from ear witnesses, including my own Rebbe, Rav Shmuel Volk. Let me correct the yeshiva hired, that's the Menachel. What Menachel? He's Rosh Yeshiva and President. Okay? There are Rabbanim, however, who continue to support the yeshiva, which ultimately became Yeshiva University. not because they agreed with the new leadership, but because they felt they had no choice. The yeshivas of Torah Vadas and Rabbeinu Yaakov Yosef did not exist yet. And the Rabbanim could not fathom a time when new yeshivas would be founded on American soil. Let me make one correction. RJJ existed from 1902 on. What is he talking about? Torah Vadas was established right after World War I as a Mizrahi yeshiva in Brooklyn. It was named Torah Vadas after the Mizrahi yeshiva in Lida, which Rav Reines established, known as Torah Vadas. When the yeshiva was about to move to its new quarters in Washington Heights, where Yeshiva University is still located today, there was an Orthodox doctor in New York, a distinguished London Talmud Chacham, who would come to the yeshiva and to talk in pilpul with the bachurim. Boy, that's fabulous English. This doctor approached Dr. Rebbe and said to him, quote, "I ask one favor of you. As you relocate to your new building, leave over at least one corner for Torah learning."
Who's the author of this thought?
The whole class knows. You were out. This is our good friend from Satma. I'm quoting from the Rav HaKollel, Yonah Landau. Rabbi Chaim Bergalevsky writes in his Sefer, Du Yublin, that when one of Rav Moshe Meir's sons went to medical school to become a doctor, he was heartbroken, fasting and crying with intense grief. He was very upset that his son, a Kohen, would spend his days in the hospital and constantly be exposed to dead bodies, transgressing the great prohibition of Tumas Lameis. When the son saw his father's tzar, he left medical school and studied to become an accountant. All right, that paragraph is right, except you don't understand what medical school is all about. Doctors, kids training to be doctors, don't spend all their times in hospitals working with dead bodies. They got to go through medical school. My grandson still spends most of his time, third year, in medical school, not in Haifa General Hospital. But look at this. Look at this. Rabbi Golevsky also relates that when the yeshiva administration began instituting secular studies, the bachurim were very upset and began a stormy protest. The Rosh Yeshiva Rav Matlin supported them in their campaign but was unable to change anything. Later, when several bachurim left Orthodox, he was very upset and cried bitterly under the unfortunate results. My dear friends, a total recreation of history. The students desperately wanted general studies. The supporters, not the Rosh Yeshiva, the Balabatim didn't want. What do we need it for? And I got news for you. Had there been general studies, a lot less fellows would have left Yiddishkeit. I sign in it. And I ask Mr. Landau, please, how many Satmas have left and written best-selling books that even my wife bought before she went on the plane, went to Barnes & Noble and said, I need something to read. And the next thing I know, we are the owners of Unorthodox. And when she finished it, honey, you got to read it. My wife says, I got to read it. Boy, did I have to read it. Oh, do I wish she would have studied with me in Machon Gold. The descent of Yeshiva Sabbath Chochanan began with a minor aberration, the introduction of secular studies into a yeshiva whose purpose was to uphold Torah and Yiddishkeit. This change caused a domino effect responsible for changing the entire face of the institution over the years. Mr. Landau, I invite you to my Sunday shiur, or to Rabbi Bednash's shiurim, or Rabbi Silverman's shiurim in this part of Yeshiva University, and I challenge you to show me any shiur in Satma that's on the level of the shiurim being given here under the aegis of Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. But the end is unbelievable. Beginning on page 297, he describes Reb Yaakov Yosef and the charity work he did. And he did wonderful work, and he describes how he organized a gemilat, chevra gemilas chasadim. You ready? My blood pressure is going to shoot up, but I have to convey the stupidity written here. And gentlemen, if you ever sell Yiddishkeit for money, you're going to answer to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and you're going to have to answer to me. In 1992, Chevra Gemilas Chasadim was founded to supply the poor with loans without interest. The great philanthropist, quote, Rabbi Yaakov Schiff, immediately donated the large sum of $1,000. Let it go on record that a Satmar Chassid writes about Jacob Schiff, who grew up on the lap of the Shemshon Fal Hirsch, and comes to America and becomes the president of Temple Emanuel, and the man who sponsored the arrival of Solomon Schechter to the United States. And because he gave a verstunkener $1,000 in today's money, let's say he gave $1,000,000 to this Gemilat Chesed, he gets the title Reb Yaakov Schiff. Believe me, he doesn't recognize that title. For money, you get honey, and you sell Kol HaTorah Kula. I challenge Rabbi Yonah Landau of Satma, Aaron Rakefet, never sold a title to anyone. Not even for $1,000, not even for $1,000,000. Gentlemen, it is unbelievable what is published. Dr. Blau, you have two choices. Either pay up your life insurance or come in Aliyah. But I want a full report of what Yonah Landau had to say to you when you informed him of the slight mistakes that he makes on page after page, but all the mistakes amount to nothing but to call Jacob Schiff, Reb Yaakov Schiff, the president of Temple Emanuel, the main supporter of JTS? Shame on you! You are unorthodox! Unorthodox! Authored by Rabbi Yonah Landau. Gentlemen, today's been a very important shiur putting down, because you're not going to understand what happens next unless you really grasp what I said today. It was a wonderful start, a wonderful institution. It begins because the kid is wild and a kid needs playmates. And Rabbi Matlin had a lot of seichel. And you bring the kids together, you put a little candy on the table. And, you know, candy, honey, a kid, and the kid has a soul, the kid learns. These were good kids. These were wonderful kids. The greenhorns come in. They need a place to acclimate. See, in Israel, you don't need that. It's a country built for absorption of immigrants. And there's no longer a melting pot here. We've lost the Mapai concept. Everyone has to look alike and think alike and vote alike. Baruch Hashem. I speak English, my children speak English, my grandchildren speak English, but they all speak Hebrew totally at home. The great-grandchildren already, I don't know if they'll be speaking English as well as their parents. It's gradual. It's a development. It's a process. It has its own inner dynamics. But America, 1890s, 1900s, 1910s, was not like that. The melting pot. America. English. Liberty. Democracy. Our history. Washington. Lincoln. It's a different country. And these students want the ability to acclimate. You'll see what I'm going to tell you next week. It'll blow your mind. You'll see what three students attempted to do. Lamish, fascinating. And we wouldn't know it except for Rabbi Gil Klapman's research. And what about the rabbinate? And of course, what we're building up to is the man who changes the course of Torah history, Rabbi Dr. Dov Revel. My dear students, one second. Yeah. One comment on something I said in Shear. If you recall, I mentioned that the Yankees had a third baseman, Bobby Brown, who later became a cardiologist. Dr. Marty Lipson writes to me from Toronto. His friend, Dr. Ron Taylor, was a major league pitcher, a member of the 1969 Mets, world champions, the Miracle Mets. He is currently a general practitioner in Toronto who has a special interest in sports medicine. He is a member of the medical staff of Mount Sinai Hospital, Toronto, and is team physician of the Toronto Blue Jays. Please note his birthday. I have to look it up, but I imagine it may be December 2nd, and I'll have to check it out. Marty, thank you for the information. Chabad, some very fascinating articles. Once again, this topic we struggle with. I mentioned it yesterday. I mentioned it in Shear today. Women. We can't live without them, but we got to try to live with them. It's a big problem. Torah, study. Here, a Chabad girl of Bal Harbor, Florida, and evidently a very elegant family if I read it and see what it's written about her. She finished the entire Shulchan Aruch HaRav, all the volumes in Hebrew and English. And that, read the article. And here, Chabad had a conference of women celebrating the 200th Yahrzeit of the Alter Rebbe of Women's Verbrengen, and here are women who were raised in different Hasidiyot, and they speak about what they gained by becoming Chabadnikot, and it's very, very fascinating. Kol HaKavod to Chabad. Next, I want to tell you, I'm hitting on a good cylinder, but I'm an Amaritz. I didn't know what Tshuva of the Tatam Sefer, Tshuva Kuf Nun Tet, where he defends himself against strictures, and towards the end of the tshuva, someone attacked him because he was mata shaving. It's not important what he was mata, but how can you be mata shaving? Jew has to have a beard. Now, what did that kefir tell you in class? I even said it recently that if these people with beards would meet the Mesilat Yesharim, the Ramchal, they would have a shock. He was totally clean-shaven. That whole cadre of scholars, the Chatam Sofer has it, word by word, quoting Rakefet. The Ramchal, others, Azari gives names, Kabbalah, totally clean-shaven. How dare you tell me that a good Jew must have a beard? Ah, I'd love to know what our friend Landau does about that. Now, finally, I want to show you how a lot of nachat, did you see this is one of the freebies they give out? I don't know, they multiply like mushrooms. This is Shvi. Iton Litzibur Hadati. By the way, there's the famous ad of Amslam that everyone's talking about, that the Rambam would vote for his party. HaRambam Chayam Matzbiya Amslam. I love it. But I'm still got to vote where I'm voting. Anyway, a fellow came out with a new disc. He's a Rosh Kollel. This young man, Harav Moshe, not so young anymore, Harav Moshe David Weissman, is our student from this very Kollel. He lives in this very Kollel. He lives in Beitar Elit, where he's a Rosh Kollel. And also, take a look, he performs, sings, composes, and it has a raving review about this disc. Do me a favor. Who asked me for this? Okay, Simcha. Simcha asked me. Simcha Lauer. Who will see Simcha Lauer today? Anybody? Please give this to him and tell him whenever he's ready to discuss it to let me know. And finally, I wouldn't miss the Shayurim next week for all the snow up in the Golan Heights, until we meet again in health and happiness, and to remind Danny to fix up the shear. When you tell me it's fixed, I'll be very happy. It'll take and give me peace of mind. Until we meet again, one second, and next week, are we voting yet? No, we still have Not next week, the 22nd. We have a week and a half, right? So it's next week. I have to give you a bracha to vote intelligently. And if you're in touch with Morty, tell him he has brains. He has Ruach HaKodesh, not from the Shota, but from another. Until we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vedanya. Ah, Seder.